This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 10th of August, 2014, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 266 of the Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up this week, we're in New York to ask how our hunger for free stuff is killing creativity.
Then follow, if you dare, historian Joanna Burke will lead us into a world of pain.
And later in the show, we find out what it takes to launch a publishing house from the ground up. Jacques Testard from Fitzcarraldo Editions will join us here in the studio.
All that and some great music too, coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. What a week it's been, Andrew. I say a story of contrasts between this week and its predecessor.
Yes, it's a little bit quieter in the office. We finished an edition actually last Saturday. We had to come in last Saturday to kind of polish off the finery. And in fact, Mr. Robert Bound, who's normally here in the studio, he's kind of disappeared to his parents in West Sussex to put his feet up.
His feet were hurting.
He's been running up and down those stairs.
Rest his weary limbs.
But yeah, so he's gone away for a few days. And yes, yeah, so a kind of semi air of calm in the office.
There's been an air. and what else is coming up? I mean, it's always every time of year is busy.
Well, no, it's the countdown to the second Monocle book with Gestalten popping into the office. That's going to be in the office in the end of August. We'll get to see copies, I think, around like 20th or something. So that's only a few weeks away. And we're even beginning on the third Gestalten book, but that's a secret. And then
this is not the forum for.
And then we're doing another
secrets.
Thing. That's also a secret. And we're looking at something for Christmas. That's also a secret. Don't tell anyone.
Keep things under your hat. Listeners, keep them under your hat.
Talking of hats, we have a new member of staff who's called Thomas Reynolds, and he has a passing resemblance to Stan Laurel.
And when you say passing resemblance, Andrew, if you mean absolute dead ringer.
Especially when you found a hat and plonked it on his head.
A special little bowler. I think he'd brought it with him. It's the only
he has been. He has been complaining of being persecuted at work.
Well, I think it's fine. Between sort of persecution and
bringing into the fold.
Good-natured badinage.
Yeah, put the hat on. And he has been heard to say a few times over the last few days, don't make me put the hat on again.
Please, sir. It's like, on it goes. What about a hat for... We've got various other members of staff. One we'll hear from in a moment. What kind of hat do you think, Andrew, would be perfect for our colleague Daniel Giacopelli?
Oh, baseball cap backwards.
Let's see what he's wearing, shall we?
And here he is, the one and only Daniel Giacopelli.
Danny, welcome.
Here
to
I
the
am.
Studio. You're hatless. Did you not get the memo?
No, I didn't get the memo.
So tell us, when you're living in Long Island, I know that isn't how you say it. How do you say it?
Long Island.
Okay. When you were on that Long Island, did you wear your baseball pack?
I did when
backwards.
I was 12 or 13 or so. And then
backwards?
Backwards. You have to curve the bill.
Oh.
But that's changed now.
The cool thing is to not curve. The cool thing a decade ago, the cool thing was not to curve. It's probably curving the bill now. The cool thing.
And tell me, did you have like a baseball one, a proper baseball one?
Yeah.
Or did you have like some funny character on the front?
I had like a Ralph Lauren one at some point. Ralph Lauren.
A window. Well,
that's a Long Island boy too.
It's like the great
from
Gatsby.
It's from the Bronx,
isn't it? Scenes from like Gatsby style youth of Daniel Giacopelli.
And I must say, he's turned up in a very nicely pressed white shirt.
Thank you very much.
You've never looked as smart as this. I thought the courts weren't in session in London on a Sunday.
For the weekly.
Of course, special effort you've made.
Shall we look at what's happening in the world?
Yeah, what's happening?
Ooh, yeah, we're fed up talking about your wardrobe.
I don't really want to stay too much on the serious stuff. I mean, there's a presidential election in Turkey today. Which we could talk about, but I'd rather not. Why don't we move straight to tomorrow, where the annual World Gold Panning Championships are happening in Sweden. So this is a contest where they have artificial pools, and the competitors pan gold to see who can pan the most in a given time.
Is Sweden a big, is that a big gold mining territory?
I don't know. It's not California, or where's gold now?
It says that they did it in Italy last year.
Yeah.
It's right. Artificial pools, so.
So it's like in a swimming pool, you kind
yeah,
of like.
Yeah, like a kiddie pool.
I don't think that's much of a competition, is it?
I think Marcus Hippie would be good at that.
Yes, he's up for kind of. Anyway, he's quite entertaining as well. Yeah, he's kind of up for anything. We could send him there. Next.
I don't really know if this is relevant, but the president of France is going to marry
François,
quote unquote, his mistress on his 60th birthday. That's happening on Tuesday. I don't think she's really a mistress anymore because he's not with his former girlfriend.
No, he's moved on.
Yeah, can you have a mistress if she's your only girlfriend?
Well, she was his mistress when he was with... I mean, don't forget, he was living with Valérie Trierweiler, wasn't he? The journalist for a number of years. And Julie Gayet, is that her name?
Yes, that's the one.
She was his mistress. I guess she remains his mistress.
Well, they're going to be married now.
And she's celebrating her 42nd birthday. I see her on the 12th of August. Happy birthday, Julie. That's greetings from London, from all of us here at Monocle 24. Have a nice birthday.
Cards in the post.
Wednesday is the annual Left-Handers Day.
Well, now, I'm interested in this.
So, are you left-handed?
No, I'm not.
Why are you particularly interested in left-handed?
Well, I often get accused. I like to wear my watch on my right wrist, and I'm often accused of being a lefty as a result.
I eat left-handed.
Really?
That is interesting.
Yes, I'm completely left-handed for eating.
You have your fork in your left hand.
Surely that's the correct
thing to do. But
you're ready. I'd have my fork in my right hand.
Everyone, Danny, so has a fork in their left hand.
How do you eat? You put the fork in the food and
the food
in your mouth. It's not that complicated.
No, but you're saying as long as you're holding the knife with the fork.
I guess on Long Island. You don't need a fork to eat a dog, right?
You don't even. Do you have knives and forks?
This is...
Anyway, I eat as a left-handed person. I'm not much of a cricketer, but if I had a cricket bat, I would do it left-handed.
What about tennis?
I'd do it right-handed.
What about...
Walking your
dog? No, I'm not telling you that one.
Do you walk...
I was going to ask you about a game of billiards. But let's ask, what happens on it? Just briefly, what happens?
This is straight from their PR, but it's intended to celebrate all things left-handed and to raise awareness of the difficulties left-handers face in a predominantly right-handed world.
There used to be a shop in London on Brewer Street that was called the Left-Handed Shop. I think it's gone now. And you could buy everything, left-handed scissors.
This is like Ned Flanders' shop in The Simpsons.
To be honest,
what's it called? The Leftporium or something.
Yeah, there was everything was left-handed,
right?
Because the lefties can't get scissors to fit their hands.
You're othering them, Andrew. Othering them.
Yeah.
Wednesday, the World Championship of Tango in Argentina is happening.
Buenos Aires.
Presumably, we're sending someone to that, aren't we?
Well.
Poor Ed Stocker, who was our Buenos Aires correspondent, has now moved to New York.
Oh, is that why he moved? A whole continent away just to escape.
He lost last year.
I like tango music, actually. It's one of my... I find it very nice. I don't know how to dance to it, but I enjoy listening to it.
Oh.
It's accordion music.
Lining you up. No, it's beautiful. I do like tango. I went to Buenos Aires this year, and we went to a couple of tango clubs. Didn't dance. Watched. Quite good. When they're like the Argentinians were doing it, but there's such a kind of a tourism thing around tango. There's a lot of kind of, what did you say, people who can't dance, being kind of just like dragged around the floor.
Oh dear.
It doesn't look very good. At least it cleans the floor.
Are you leading with your left hand or your right hand?
I wasn't dancing. I had my hand around a beer.
I see.
That's okay. All I can say.
Tom, much of a dancer?
No, just look at me. Look at the way you know. What do you know of me?
I saw you both on the dance floor at the Monaco Christmas party.
Well, that's the British skill of being able to dance in sort of proportion with how much alcohol
I was going to say.
Enjoyed.
And finally?
Finally, not so funny, but worth noting, 100 years ago, the Panama Canal was made, which is kind of fascinating.
Was made?
Well, it was...
A bit of a strange turn of phrase.
The earth was destroyed.
Oh, just made. I've made a canal.
Is this being marked in any way?
The Panama Canal was completed.
It was dug.
Curated 100 years ago.
Is there not talk of widening this celebrated passage?
I think they're widening it as we speak.
Well, they're competing with the one in Nicaragua that Chinese billionaire has
proposed. I'm not holding my breath for that one.
The Panamanians say there's no way that the one in Nicaragua is actually going to happen because they know firsthand how hard it is. But there we go. That's the news next week, guys.
You certainly dug new depths this week, as they say.
That's good.
That was quite good, isn't it? Relevant. All relevant. And a big left-handed clap to you.
That's the sound of it right there. Thank you, Danny. This is The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be back after this. We'll be considering free content and why it's probably not good news for creativity. Stay tuned. Now, it's a fact of the modern-day media that there's often a disconnect between what consumers expect to enjoy for free and what businesses in the sector and the creative forces that populate the space expect to be paid for. This gulf, the legacy perhaps of the early days of the web and the file-sharing culture that was possibly the key driver for internet growth, is a pretty complex space to negotiate.
One man who has both insight into this phenomenon and a certain sensibility about the price, for want of a better word, that can be paid by artists and creatives who are denied their dues because of a voracious and sometimes freeloading audience, is Chris Ruin.
He's written a new book called Freeloading: How Our Insatiable Appetite for Free Content Starves Creativity. And he joins us now from Monocle's New York Bureau. Chris, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to speak with you. I wonder whether it is a straight sort of battle, if you like, between, you know, the freeloaders and the creatives. And if it is, where do you stand? Are you sort of on the middle ground, if you like, between the two?
Well, you know, I think content companies are not the only big business interests in this debate. Google maybe used to be a small upstart company, but now they're one of the most powerful corporations in the world. And tech companies are making millions and billions off of serving content, in many cases for free. And ultimately, the ease with which they can get around copyright laws and not have to, you know, follow contracts with artists, and the fact that the artists don't really have a choice in how their work is being distributed, you know, that's really the issue. Now, on the consumer end, if you're just a consumer and you're using a search engine and you know you can enter the name of a movie or an album and you're going to get it very easily, unless someone really confronts you about it, which hasn't happened very much in the past decade plus, you're probably not going to think too much about whether this is immoral or good for the artist or not. You're just going to do it because you're used to it. So where I stand is, I understand on the fan side that if something's really easy and nobody's challenging you on whether it's good or bad, you're just going to do it. You're going to take that free content. What became really obvious to me writing the book was we're not just dealing with free culture, quote unquote, here. We're dealing with a black market for creativity and for art. And the people who are losing in the immediate sense are the artists. And you know, I definitely stand with the artists, and obviously as an author and a writer, I stand with the artists, and it's not about artists being rich. You know, it's misconstrued often in this debate that people like me are saying that all artists deserve to make a lot of money. That's not true. The principle is, if millions of dollars and billions of dollars is being made off of advertising and subscriptions for people's creative work, they deserve a cut. They deserve a fair cut. And, you know, maybe that means they'll be able to make a living. Maybe it means they won't, because it's hard to make a living doing art. But, you know, that's my basic thrust. I'm standing with the artists, but I'm trying to negotiate, really, this conversation between artists and fans, because I come from the fan side.
Chris, can I ask you, it depends, I guess, what sector of the worlds of creativity you look at. Because in the music industry, what seems to happen, yes, you know, people don't earn enough money from the music they make. It gets shared in all sorts of ways that they probably aren't that happy with, but many of the bands have kind of moved on, haven't they? They've kind of given up on the idea that they'll make their money from, you know, sales of tracks, and they make their money from touring and from appearing at gigs, and that's their income source now. So in a way, it's great to be critical of what's happened, but in a way, people have moved on, haven't they?
Not really, because if you look at the money that's being made in the industry, there's still billions of dollars coming in through sales of music. I think there's sort of a hive mentality, hive mindset that's come in that, oh, record labels are dead. Artists aren't making any money from sales anymore, including digital sales. And if you look at the numbers, it's just not true. Digital sales were increasing by, you know, over 10% every single year up until this year. And the reason for that isn't piracy. It's arguably because of streaming and Spotify. And, you know, some consumers who were probably paying some money for digital tracks now paying nothing for the free Spotify options. Now, you know, yes, some artists probably have given up, and, you know, younger artists don't expect to make very much money from their recordings, and but, you know, major artists are still raking in the cash, and that is, in fact, what's driving the industry. You know, and it's important to, when you're we're talking about live and live revenues, most of that money is going to the same artists who are still making money off of recorded music. It's still going to artists who made their names in the 60s and 70s and 80s with the benefit of, you know, big multi-million dollar promotional budgets from record labels. So it's not as if that's solving the problem. I talked to artists and people from record labels researching this book. They all said the same thing, which is that touring is really expensive. And, you know, you're lucky just to break even on tour. So I think artists are feeling the squeeze, but they've been conditioned over the years to keep their mouths shut. And there is still a culture of fear out there where even if an artist, you know, becomes aware of the conditions that they're facing and says, oh, that's not fair, they don't think they're in a position to speak on it. So, you know, hopefully that's where people like me come in and writers and things have changed. You know, when I wrote this book, no artists were speaking out. And now there's Tom York has spoken out, David Byrne has spoken out, David Lowery. I mean, there's been a parade of artists who all of a sudden are saying, well, wait a minute here, what is this new world, and is it fair, and can we imagine something better?
Chris, what about in other realms and the impact that that's had on this? Because you've got a lot of digital output that is very purposefully given away. I think particularly in terms of written media, a lot of newspapers or news organizations who make a point, and it's almost a principle of their operations, sometimes a founding principle of their digital operations, that they give their content away. Is that not part of the problem, that they've generated an environment where people expect to get something for nothing? And it's very hard to rein back on that once that's what you've become familiar with.
I think you're absolutely right. It is very hard to rein back on it once people become accustomed to it, and it, you know, it takes some effort. You know, about 2008, 2009, especially when the Great Recession was hitting, it just became commonplace for people to be saying, oh, newspapers are going to be gone in 5 years. Nobody's going to pay for anything. You know, record labels are going to be gone. Book publishing is going to be gone. And people didn't take into account that there was also an economic collapse going on. So all the numbers that were coming out from the industry, you know, were definitely feeling the effects of that. And but I think, given those conditions, people assumed, okay, these guys must be right. These guys saying that you can't charge for anything must be right. So they gave it away for free. But something, you know, I was just looking at the latest numbers from the newspaper industry. And in the U.S. at least, it's doing okay. You know, it's still losing some money, but it's not like it was. All the growth and stability is coming from paywalls. So in fact, you know, it may be happening slowly, but newspapers are gradually figuring out a way to ask their customers to pay. Now, will the amount that newspapers get from paywalls actually translate into sustainable revenues for them to operate? That's something no one really knows. But in fact, when just at the point where it looked like everything was going to be free, and people were so confident in predicting that, you know, the internet was just going to destroy all of these business models, it didn't happen. So what we have right now are all of these markets operating at sort of a substandard level where some people are paying, but not as many people as could be paying. I think aggregation sites are actually a huge problem, and I'm not exactly sure what the solution is to them, but, you know, I read Gawker, the US-based site, and about half their articles are just coming from New York Times original reporting. And it seems to me that there must be some solution out there where the entities doing the original reporting can get some kind of compensation when their work is being spread around and being profited off of for advertising. But, you know, you're right. It takes effort to walk back from the first decade. But it's also important to recognize, you know, we're very early in this digital transition. And we probably have a ways to go before the mores and you know, values are settled.
You may not be able to solve that problem, but did you come up with some ideas of solutions? You know, here in Europe, for example, we're seeing in France and Germany moves to make sure that if some story is, for example, searched and clicked through on a search engine, that some money goes to the newspaper group, because it's recognised that many newspaper groups, as you say, are suffering because their content is being taken by other people. So if you do link to it, you should pay in some sense. Very hard to kind of collect that. And we see in the film industry, you know, you see one or two big kind of piracy kings being encircled by American authorities, even if they live in quiet New Zealand. And, you know, someone comes knocking on their door. So some industries seem to be better at kind of that fight back, do you think?
Well, the movie industry seems to be sort of the last at least in the States, they're sort of the last men standing in fighting, because the music industry, although they're trying to do something about the problem, after what happened with the Stop Online Piracy Act here, they've practically given up. So the movie industry seems to be the only people who still have some fight left in them. But really, everybody's facing the same problem, which is one website or another, one service or another, exploiting regulatory loopholes. Now, in a lot of ways, Europe is the best hope for artists going forward, because we, in the States, we seem to be a little bit behind you guys on just respecting copyright and respecting artists' rights. But I've been making this argument to see the Pirate Bay and to see Mega Upload and all of their ilk as members of a black market that are simply, they don't have to follow the normal rules of commerce. There's a study that came out by the Digital Citizens Alliance that said, you know, the top 30 infringing sites, main infringing sites, are taking in an average of $4.4 million a year. They're operating at profit margins of 80 to 94%. Again, this should not be construed as free culture. This is very much for profit. So I do think that if that message can be repeated, if more artists can get involved, you know, it's just a question of adding pressure into the mix. And I'm very hopeful and actually quite confident that as long as artists stay involved, the legislation and the regulations are going to follow.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. That was Chris Ruin, author of Freeloading, How Our Insatiable Appetite for Free Content Starves Creativity. And that's published by Scribe, and it's out in the UK now. Chris, thanks very much indeed for joining us from New York. Time, I think, Andrew, would you agree for some music? Okay, well, let's play this. We were hearing from Danny a little earlier about the World Tango Championship, so I feel it's only right. Let's play a little contemporary tango music. Gotan Project, this is Santa Maria. And that was Santa Maria, Gotan Project, of course, from way back in 2001. You're listening to The Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana, the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9 to 5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Our next guest is the writer, editor and translator Jacques Testard. Jacques is a founding editor of The White Review, an arts and culture quarterly based in London, and he has written for a number of publications, including The Times Literary Supplement, The Paris Review Daily and The New Statesman.
He's now launching a new literary publishing house called Fitzcarraldo Editions. Fitzcarraldo aims to publish 6 books a year initially, 3 novels and 3 long-form essays. The first title is Zone by Matthias Ennard, to be followed in late September by Memory Theatre, an essay by Simon Critchley, described by David Mitchell as one-of-a-kind mind game occupying the frontier between philosophy, memoir and fiction.
So what goes into building a literary press from the ground up? Well, I'm pleased to say that Jacques joins us in the studio now. we always hear that, you know, the world of publishing is challenged, that people only want to kind of get the latest gossip and the latest celebrity read. You're swimming very clearly in the other direction. What made you decide to go against the tide?
I start off by saying I was never really in that tide. I've always worked in what I guess people call literary publishing, and founding The White Review a few years ago was the culmination of a few years of thinking of what to do with my life and finding myself in a place where I could, you know, set off and start that kind of project. That was 4 years ago, and since then I've worked for another publishing house called Notting Hill Editions, where I published long-form essays in hardback form by contemporary writers.
But you spotted in the market then an appetite for something that was decidedly highbrow, for want of a better word. There was, you know, that was intelligent, that could engage with philosophy, that could engage with complicated topics. You didn't feel that world has kind of disappeared from publishing?
No, and in fact I'd say there's probably a dearth of serious publishing, particularly in London. There aren't very many publishers at all publishing the kind of fiction that I like to read, for a start, and that I've found through editing The White Review that other people like to read as well. And I did feel like there was a gap in the market, but not necessarily just for things that are highbrow, so to speak. I mean, there's the fiction on one side, a novel like Zone, which is 528 pages and has no full stops, which might scare some people. I mean, that's the hard sell. But also for long-form essays as well, that publishers haven't really been touching in this country for a long time, since the 80s, pretty much. Whereas a book, you know, the length of Critchley's essay, which is 72 pages, is something that'd be very commonly found in a bookshop in Paris or Berlin. So it was kind of bringing two passions of mine, serious, ambitious fiction, and then the essay form as well.
And what about the sort of looking at this kind of holistically, like taking the book back and looking at it from as a designed object as well? I mean, is that a certain kind of appeal that you can control, if you like, an entire process from early liaisons with the actual original creative forces behind the books, the writers, authors and illustrators in certain cases, but then also in terms of book design, production and paper, to bring some of, I guess, it almost that sort of more magazine-y sensibility into the formal publishing process?
Yeah, I mean, that only really happens when you're doing the first book, so all the books will kind of follow this design. But I was fortunate enough to work with the same designer I've worked on at The White Review with, and he's an incredible designer. He's a type specialist, so he drew a typeface. Yeah, he drew a typeface especially. It's called Fitzcarraldo. And we had a very clear idea of what we wanted the design to be. So I guess you could call it radically classical. It's clearly influenced by classical imprints like Gallimard in Paris that started off in the late 1890s, also by the Ulysses era Bodley Head. And we wanted something that was, you know, that had that kind of classical look to it, but revamped and with a contemporary bent.
Because when you look at your books, you get the feeling that you could have been around for 100 years as a publisher. There's something nice and classic about got these kind of great French flaps on the front and the back of the book. Tell me a little bit about the setting up of it. Did you need, you know, a lot of money behind you? Is it complicated to do short runs of books?
It does cost money. It does, of course. I was fortunate enough to have some investors backing me after I decided to leave Notting Hill Editions a few months ago.
But when you start off, can you publish 1,000 books? Are you publishing tens of thousands? How do you gauge this market for your books?
Well, that's based on experience. So at Notting Hill, I was doing print runs anywhere between 1,000 and 5,000. So based on sales, I guess that's how you kind of gauge it. So the Critchley's 2,000 copies. Actually, they're both 2,000, which is a small print run by, I guess, big publisher standards, but for an indie, it's perfectly respectable. It does cost money, but I guess it's not just the printing that costs money. The design costs money. The distribution and the sales cost money. I mean, it's not a business you go into wanting to make money. It's a nice thing to spend your time doing.
Absolutely. I just wondered, in terms of the response from other players in the sort of publishing industry, be they the sort of big dogs who wonder who the sort of young upstart is, or other smaller publishers who, you know, really sort of identify with that sort of sensibility. What's the reaction been? Have people been very encouraging? I wonder whether any of the big players are maybe a mite condescending about it. Have you found that, or have they generally been very welcoming to you into the sort of that whole theatre?
The books haven't come out yet, so it's there hasn't been that much reaction. As a general rule, publishing industry tends to be quite supportive. People who like books tend to
kind of support the book as a whole, which isn't to say there isn't a lot of bitching as well, but I haven't encountered any of that yet.
And explain to us why you decided to name yourself after Fitzcrowder.
Yeah, that was a maybe not so subtle metaphor on the madness of setting up a publishing house.
And so what happens next? So the first you come out, and do you already have lined up what you'll do after this?
Yeah, so I'll be publishing an essay by a young American writer in February 2015. She's called Eula Biss and published by Grey Wolf Press in America. And it's called On Immunity and Inoculation. And it takes the vaccination of her newborn baby as a kind of starting point, talk about paranoia in wider society. I mean, it jumps from lots of different subjects, but that's the starting point. And it's the kind of great American nonfiction tradition.
And just tell me this, the idea of doing translation as well. I know that's something you're also keen on. Again, setting yourself quite a task, you've got to get it translated even before you publish your first book. But with your name, does that mean you'll be particularly looking at French?
Mathias Sénard is French. Fortunately, that book was translated already, okay. So I didn't have to wait too long, because it is a very big book.
That would have been quite a few evenings in before launched your publications.
And just briefly on that, we did mention already this sort of absence of points in this. I wonder whether, you know, do you ever find the challenges of reading, you know, certain more challenging fiction, where it's challenging by its structure or by its content, do you ever worry that even in a relatively small print run, you might risk losing maybe some of your readers if it's a particularly kind of challenging piece, or do you just think these are the things I like?
No, obviously not. I wouldn't publish a book that I didn't think was readable and that other people would appreciate.
Not unreadable, but you know, where does the sort of the challenge, that thrill end, and then the sort of easy accessibility begin, I wonder?
Well, I guess it's entirely subjective, because to a certain degree it's my taste. But this isn't a book that I've plucked out of nowhere. It did really well in France. It sold 65,000 copies. It was a kind of underground hit in America as well when it first came out 2 years ago. It did well in Germany as well. I think it sold close to 10,000. So it's, you know, it's a book that's, for a serious and ambitious novel, has sold quite a lot of copies. The formal innovation, the lack of full stops, is almost, it's more of a kind of formal conceit than anything else. It doesn't hinder the experience of reading the book. But to answer your question about where that stops, I guess, yeah, it's entirely subjective. If I don't get something, then I can then touch it.
That's a pretty fair answer, I'd say.
And finally, perhaps you could just tell us, you know, so when you go, you talked about some of the complications of going out to, you know, the trade and distribution. Are you finding that this is a sell to an independent bookstore here in the UK? Who are you finding kind of taking up the books?
Well, the sales and distribution are being handled by Faber. They have a dedicated sales and distribution team that take on independent publishers. So they're handling that whole aspect of things for me, which is incredibly useful, because I don't know much about it, nor do I have the time to learn, really. So yeah, it's definitely aimed at independent bookshops, and also kind of design bookshops, art bookshops, you know, galleries, museums, and all the rest of it. And the books will be on sale as well on my website and on Amazon and all the rest of it.
Well, Jacques, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That was Jacques Testard of Fitzcarraldo Editions.
Up next on the programme, we're entering a world of pain, in a manner of speaking, so stay tuned for that.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Win Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, the story of pain may not be top of everyone's list of topics for a Sunday lunchtime, but if you've previously written prize-winning books on subjects as wide-ranging and challenging as warfare, psychology, the emotions, rape, fear, and the human-animal divide, then maybe there's less to fear than might be expected from documenting the history of human pain from the start of the 18th century to the present day.
And that is precisely what our next guest, Joanna Burke, Professor of History at Birkbeck College here in London, has done. From the language of human suffering through to the impact that religion and science have had on the understanding of pain, Joanna delves into many areas that have proven, well, simply too painful to have been explored before in her new volume, The Story of Pain, From Prayers to Painkillers.
And I'm delighted to say that Joanna joins us now here on the Monocle Weekly. Joanna, thanks for being with us. The history of pain, it's a pretty challenging subject matter, fairly nebulous concept almost. I wondered whether, as you wrote the book, you found that pain itself had changed through, you know, through history as you studied it, or is it more about people's perceptions of it and the language they use to describe it?
I think one of the really interesting things, at least for me, with writing this book, was just to find out just how much pain has changed over time. That, you know, the way people, not only the way people bring meaning to and understand pain, but also the way they actually experienced it. And I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, we all know that the languages used to speak about pain change. But those languages and those changes actually influence the way people actually experience pain.
Tell me though, Joanna, because I guess the strangest thing about pain is, you know, you talk about the, how people describe it, but it's one of the most alienating things and oddly the most uniting things. You know, we have empathy for people's pain in certain situations, but often when people have enduring pain, I was struck by people who are very sick, how they often end up kind of enduring it on their own in a way, because it's a hard thing to explain. And no matter how much you know, for example, love somebody, to tap into their pain is a very difficult thing.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. Pain is very, very alienating. Sometimes it almost seems like your body is outside of yourself. The other thing about pain is that it is something that a lot of people in pain don't like talking about, because by talking about pain, not only do you resurrect it for yourself, but you also can end up inflicting pain on your loved ones. So, you know, there's a wonderful story I remember reading, an account of pain in the 19th century, a memoir, where this woman was saying how she was in great pain, and then she looked up and she saw her sister weeping in the corner, and she said to her sister, "Why are you crying? I'm the one in pain." And the sister said, "But your pain is causing me to have pain." And then shortly after that, her mother comes into the room and asks, "Well, how are you feeling?" And she simply says, I'm okay." You know, so this idea that a person in pain can actually end up becoming, or fear that they end up becoming an inflictor of pain. So I think that's important. The other thing I think we have to remember, though, is that, you know, pain is not the only experience that's difficult to communicate. I mean, just try and think about, you know, how we talk about sexual love or parental love indeed. You know, these things are all very, very difficult to talk about, and we all sort of end up clutching at cliches in order to express it, but we still try to express these things.
And I guess, Joanna, a lot of those cliches, or some of them certainly, will come from almost the religious realm, because there is this tradition when it comes to pain and the suffering of agonizing physical pain that it's character forming. I don't know whether you found that was something that was influenced by religion, or whether in the secular realm there was something similar about this kind of character forming notion. Is that something that we've gotten over now in the modern world, or do you think there's still a legacy of that?
Religious languages remain, I think, the most important ways we have to talk about pain. We still talk about pain as though somehow it's redemptive, that somehow, you know, you suffer in this life so you don't have to suffer in the next, or that it creates character, it makes you stronger, that pain is something inflicted on humanity to teach you a lesson, either a lesson from God, i.e. you shouldn't sin as much, or you shouldn't drink as much alcohol, or indeed something inflicted by nature with a capital N, that somehow this is nature's way of teaching us how we ought to behave. Those languages do remain with us, even in our highly secular society. They are still there. Now, it is the case that we do have other languages for pain, and these are languages taken from secular literature. I mean, there's a wonderful, wonderful book written by Virginia Woolf in 1928 called On Being Ill, and I really, really recommend it. It's fantastic. Where she makes an argument that, you know, the merest schoolgirl, when she falls in love, has the language of Shakespeare to draw on, but let her try to describe a headache to her doctor and language what runs dry. You know, but we do have the language, secular language, to use to talk about pain, as well as that religious language.
That notion of faith and pain, and the idea that you should, you should suffer to kind of gain. That I guess we have the notion of no pain, no gain. It seems to have come up recently in the debate about dignitas and this idea that when you're very sick, you should no longer have to suffer right to the very end. And for many religious people, that still seems to be kind of, cheap words, but a cop out. That you should kind of go through that last journey of pain to reach the other side, as it were. Do you find that? What's your take on that debate?
I think it's really important that we listen to the people who are suffering pain. It's their life, it's their bodies, it's their experience. So, of course, on the one hand, personally, I am very, very sympathetic to those people who argue, and I would be one of these people, that I don't want to suffer terrible agony until the last minute. But we do, at the same time, I think we do have to acknowledge that for some people, there can be something good that comes out of that suffering for them. And after all, it's their death. And I think that's what we need to respect.
There's an amazing chapter in your book completely about pain relief and about the kind of history of it. And it wasn't always an easygoing thing, was it?
I loved writing the chapter on pain relief because I learned such a lot. I mean, I think there are two really, really interesting paradoxes. On the one hand, we're talking now 19th century. On the one hand, you have the scientific knowledge about how to alleviate pain, but people are not using it. So in other words, well before 1946 and 47, scientists, doctors knew about ether and chloroform and what, and they could relieve pain, but they did not use that in operations. So that's the first paradox, 19th century. The second paradox is actually now, late 20th and early 21st century, where we have the under-medicalization of pain. So again, we know how to alleviate most kinds of pain. Chronic pain, some forms of chronic pain are exceptions, but most forms, and yet there's still the under-medicalization of pain. Those are the two paradoxes, I think.
And there's some interesting examples in the book, Joanna, where we talk about why some of those assumptions or, mistakes are made historically. And there's often been a lot of societal assumptions or assumptions about people's class or their race, which has led to these fundamental misunderstandings. I wonder, do you think there's still the legacy of that today? I mean, you mentioned this underuse, if you like, of the medical resources at our disposal. Do you detect the legacy of some of those old misconceptions about people?
Unfortunately, there is that legacy that some people don't feel as much as others remains with us. So today we have really good evidence to show that for the same levels of pain, for the same illnesses, same diseases, certain groups of people in our society are much more likely to be under-medicalized, to get less pain relief than other members in our society. That remains with us, and I think that's it's one of the big problems that we have. And in a sense, these groups, so they're the groups we would expect, in other words, they're minorities within our society, or they're women within our society, these groups are in a sort of a very difficult catch-22 situation. On the one hand, if they complain about the severity of the pain they are feeling, then they are regarded as hysterical or exaggerating. If they don't complain about the extent of suffering that they are going through, then it's because they're not as sensitive as other people. So, they can't win whatever they do.
Now, obviously, the book is an historical book, but I know that you wanted to draw some lessons for how we treat pain today. And one of those you've already touched on is the idea that we should certainly be listening to the people suffering from pain and what they want to happen. But what were the other kind of lessons for contemporary times that you discovered from doing this book?
I think one of the things I personally discovered in writing, researching this book, is the healing nature and the comfort that people in pain get from being listened to, from being heard, and that in itself actually speeds up and helps that healing process, helps the person get better and in fact not to feel the pain as much. I think that's one of the really big things that I personally learned. There are other things, of course, as well, and this is why I think history is important, because what history does is it shows us that things are not always the same and that we can change things. We can change ourselves. We can change our responses to pain. We can use pain, not to alienate ourselves from other people, or indeed people in pain from their communities, but the opposite. We can actually use pain and stories of pain, indeed, to actually create communities in a much more lively and creative ways. And that's another thing I think I personally learned.
Joanna, I was just wondering, I mean, you talk a lot in the book about how tricky it is to define, you know, the sort of the language of pain as well, in fact. You talk a lot about the, you know, the tedium of suffering pain, how obviously unpleasant it can be. And I just wondered, as bringing your sort of writerly voice to bear on things, you hear those words, tedium, unpleasantness, this difficulty in defining the sensations. Why on earth would you want to write about it in the first place?
Why would I want to write about pain? Well, actually, I remember the moment when I decided to write a book about pain. I was actually in hospital myself after a major operation. And on one hand, you know, I was pressing the opium, the morphine pump desperately, and it wasn't really working. And yet I was too polite to sort of complain to the nurse. And on the other hand, I was reading Virginia Woolf's wonderful book on being ill, published in 1928, but still in press. And in her book, she talks about the difficulties of communicating pain. Anyway, at that stage, my partner came in, was visiting ours. And I remember telling him very excitedly, and I was in great pain, but I remember telling him about the book I was reading and telling him and describing my pain, etc. And all of a sudden, I saw his face kind of changed. And he turned to me and he says, "Joanna, you're talking about how difficult it is to talk about pain, but do you realize you've been talking about it to me for the last hour and a half?" And that really struck me. And you know, he said, you know, that maybe the problem is not that we have difficulty, people in pain have difficulty talking about pain, but that witnesses to their pain have difficulty listening. And I think that was where I thought, actually, this is something that I really would like to do much more work on, both academically, but also in terms of telling the stories of pain that people, said in the past.
Indeed. And the story is told in The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. Joanna Burke, the book is published by Oxford University Press. Joanna, thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly. Andrew, that brings us to the end of this 266th edition of the Monaco Weekly. If you like, we fold that French flap closed on another week's edition.
We had pain, we had pleasure,
we had
Danny Giacopelli.
Ruin.
Well, that was kind of all wrapped into one, the pain and the pleasure.
Somewhere in between. Yeah, we went from pain to ruin as the show ticked through.
But very nice show. Interesting, you sat me down with a piece of paper and asked me to write lots of words about pain. It's quite a complicated subject. That's why she's bright, isn't it? That's why she's at Birkbeck College, not us.
Exactly. We had some pretty smart people on the show. Us, you and I, you and I, you and I accepted, of course. Well, what a show it was.
Yeah, it was a good one. We're going to be around next week. Are you here? Or is Mr. Bobbitt bound?
I think Bobbitt bound. I think he should be bouncing back into the studio. But who knows? We'll have to check the schedules.
Well,
but I should make a fleeting appearance one way or the other.
Well, let's just take time then to thank all the people that made this show possible today. One of them was our producer. That was Daniel Giacopelli.
And we should thank our studio manager. Well, we've had a few hands on the tiller helping us, haven't we? Sam MP, Claire O'Barn.
That's two.
All of our friends.
That's two on the tiller. But don't forget, we will be here next week. But for me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
It's time to say goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in.